All right, we're now to the middle chapter of the unit. And this is the first chapter that really involves a long process. We're going to study a process, whereas it's as opposed to just a collection of facts, which are kind of like what the other chapters have been. The reason I'm bothering to mention this is that on my bonus points page on the Hoffman site, I list several recommendations for doing well in the course, as you've seen if you've read that. One of which is to try to give your own lectures. And that's a good idea. It's been a good idea all term. I don't know whether you've tried it or not, but if you haven't tried, or whether you've tried it or not, this is an ideal chapter to try it on because it's a process, meaning that there's a certain order of events. And so it lends itself well to putting away your notes and trying to explain things from beginning to end in the order in which they happen. That's a perfect way to prepare for this exam, which is typically the most difficult one for people in this course. Okay, but anyway, the chapter title, unfortunately, is cellular respiration. I say unfortunately because even though that's an important part of the chapter, it's not all of it. The chapter is about an even bigger process that cellular respiration is only part of. The overall process that this chapter is about is the complete oxidation of fuel. And since the master fuel for cells in general, the most important fuel, is glucose, I'll specifically say that this chapter is about the complete oxidation of glucose. All right? Well, cellular respiration is part of that overall process, but it's not the whole thing. And that's why I wish that the chapter weren't named that. And also, this first slide, instead of saying cellular respiration here, I wish it said complete oxidation of glucose instead. The slide, by the way, is showing you a couple things, one of which is I've mentioned before. The box here with the dashed line represents an ecosystem. And what I've told you before in a different chapter is that for any given ecosystem, at least the ones on the surface of the Earth, energy flows through the system, comes in as sunlight, gets transformed and transferred while it's in the ecosystem, and then leaves as heat. We've mentioned this before already. So that's just review. But what we haven't talked about, and what's represented by these organelles, is that there is a reciprocal relationship between two very important processes, which are the focus of this chapter and the next, the rest of the unit. Those two processes are, as I said, the complete oxidation of glucose, which here says cellular respiration, but it really should be complete oxidation of glucose. And the other process is photosynthesis. Now, I said that there's a reciprocal relationship between these two processes. And what I mean by that is that each one undoes the other, which is indicated by the arrows here. Another way of saying that is that each process produces the things that the other process needs. And this is why the other half of what I said is true of ecosystems is that materials get recycled. They don't pass through the ecosystem, they get recycled. They're part of photosynthesis, then they're part of complete oxidation of glucose, and so on. Okay, now, another thing about this that's really kind of unfortunate is that it shows you membrane-bounded organelles. Mitochondrion to represent cellular respiration, chloroplast for photosynthesis. The reason I say unfortunate is that these processes don't occur only in eukaryotes. And in fact, they were invented by prokaryotes. There's a whole history of photosynthesis before there was even such a thing as a eukaryotic cell. And also, bacteria invented cellular respiration before there was even any such thing as a eukaryotic cell. Well, photosynthesis, whether it occurs in a bacterium or a eukaryote, is a process that takes carbon in inorganic form. CO2, recall, is inorganic. Right? We've talked about what makes something organic. It's not simply that it includes carbon. There are carbon-containing compounds that aren't considered organic. CO2 is among them. So photosynthesis takes inorganic carbon and uses that carbon to produce organic compounds. When you use an inorganic source of carbon to produce organic compounds, that is called carbon fixation. And that is the big deal about photosynthesis. Because only producers are able to do this. Ecologically speaking, there are two kinds of organisms in the world: producers and consumers. All organisms, whether they're producers or consumers, need organic molecules. That's what we're made out of, right? We need it not just for fuel, but for the various parts of our cells. That's what all organisms are made out of, organic molecules. So all organisms require organic compounds. But only producers can make their own out of carbon from inorganic sources. Only producers can fix carbon, in other words, into organic compounds. We producers, therefore, absolutely rely on producers to exist. Because we have to get our carbon already in organic form. In other words, organic compounds that are made by other organisms. We do this by eating. Well, the photosynthetic organism can feed itself because it can take in inorganic carbon in the form of CO2 and make it into organic compounds. Okay, well, CO2 is not the only input, though. There's water as well. And I'll explain why water is an input into photosynthesis in the next chapter. But these are the two inputs, material inputs, CO2 and water. Photosynthesis is a complex set of reactions. It's not a single reaction. It's multiple pathways even, not just multiple reactions. It's multiple pathways. So it's complex as far as the chemistry that's going on. But just like you can represent a generic pathway that we've looked at as happening in one step, even though it doesn't, you can represent photosynthesis that way. It doesn't happen in one step, but you can pretend it does when you write what is called a summary reaction. And the summary reaction for photosynthesis is CO2 and water become organic molecules. We'll just specifically say glucose and oxygen. All right. If you want to actually put it in symbols, it is 6 CO2s and 6 waters become a glucose, which is C6H12O6, and 6 oxygens. Okay, so glucose, which is here represented by the phrase organic molecules, and oxygen are the outputs. Well, this is back to the reciprocal relationship. I said that the two processes undo each other. So this is the summary reaction for photosynthesis, even though it happens in multiple steps. Well, the summary reaction for the other process, which is the complete oxidation of glucose, is exactly the reverse of this. Right? You could write it, I'll just write it with a leftward arrow. So you'd start with glucose and oxygen, and you turn that into six carbon dioxides and six waters, which are the two things that can then go around for another turn by feeding photosynthesis, right? And so they each process undoes the other process. What I haven't mentioned here is energy. Photosynthesis builds up a big glucose out of small CO2s. And there, what's another name for that? Yes, but metabolically speaking, what kind of metabolism is that? What are the two parts of metabolism? Yes, photosynthesis is anabolic. Well, energetically, what do you expect an anabolic reaction or series of reactions to be? The word anabolic refers to the fact you're building things up. What is the corresponding word that refers to the energy involved? Endergonic, exactly. To build up large molecules like glucose, you have to supply energy from outside the system. That's the sunlight. So in the summary reaction, these are the materials, but energy could be written in there just as the word energy as an input for the summary reaction of photosynthesis. The complete oxidation of glucose, which is the reverse, has energy as an output. Glucose is fuel. And when we oxidize fuels, which is what the complete oxidation of glucose refers to, we tap the energy that is in chemical bond form. There's energy stored as potential chemical energy in the bonds of fuel. And by dismantling that fuel and oxidizing it, we can get that energy out of it and use some of it. Of course, we're always going to waste some as heat, which is why we never get as much out to do work as is actually in that fuel. But we can get some of it out and use it. And we don't use the energy that is released from fuel directly to perform the work. There's all kinds of endergonic processes that cells have to do in order to stay alive. Those endergonic processes require, by definition, energy, right? What I'm trying to say is that the energy that comes out of our fuels isn't directly used to power those endergonic processes. Instead, there's an energetic middleman, ATP. So the energy that is released by the fuels that we oxidize or burn is directly put into creating ATP molecules, which are now storing some of that energy that was in the fuel. And then we turn around and use that ATP to release the energy again from the ATP in order to power the endergonic process. So it's an energetic middleman. All right?
Defining carbon fixation.
Yeah, it is the incorporation of carbon from an inorganic source into organic compounds. And photosynthesis, that's the very special thing about photosynthesis, is that it involves carbon fixation. No animal can do that. No producer of any kind, whether it's animal or otherwise, can do that. Only producers can do that. All right, now to two. Is this the room that has the right clock? The correct time? Looks like it.
Yeah.
Oh, has mine stopped? That's right, 10 till? Looks like I might need a battery. Okay, anyway, in slide two, we're looking at a redox reaction. And remember I told you when I defined this in lab weeks ago that it was important for that day to understand that day's lab, but I said we're going to talk a lot more about redox upstairs. Well, that's now, starting now. And let's first reacquaint ourselves with what redox is. It's short for what?
Reduction and oxidation.
Reduction and oxidation. And it's good to make that into one word because that reminds us of the fact that you can't have one without the other. If you have reduction, you also have to have oxidation and vice versa. That's just common sense, right? Because reduction is what? The gaining of an electron. Well, the electron doesn't just pop into existence, which is why if something gains an electron, something else has to lose an electron for that to happen. That's why you have reduction and oxidation always occurring hand in hand. Okay, but keep in mind the confusing terminology. Gaining an electron is reduction, which will make sense if you think about the fact that an electron carries a negative charge. So when you add an electron to something, you're making the charge go down numerically because you're adding a negative one. All right? Oxidation, on the other hand, is the loss of an electron. Well, here we have a simple redox reaction, which is an ionization. Any ionization is a redox, of course, right? Because ionization occurs because of transfer of electrons, as we've talked about. This is the same exact reaction that we started with, ionization, when we first started talking about ions. Sodium, neutral, chlorine, neutral, become sodium ion and chloride ion by the metal transferring the electron to the nonmetal. And so, without looking at the blue letters, which I'm sure you're already looking at, you should know which one gets reduced, right? The thing that gets reduced is the thing that gains the electron. That's the nonmetal ion, or the nonmetal in this case, right? It becomes reduced into chloride ion. But keep in mind that the thing that becomes reduced is called the oxidizing agent. Because by becoming reduced, it allows something else to become oxidized. It receives the electron from the sodium, and therefore it causes the sodium to become oxidized. And that's why the thing becoming reduced is called the oxidizing agent. Correspondingly, the thing that's becoming oxidized is also called the reducing agent. Right? That's a pretty straightforward example. It should make sense to you based on the definition of reduction and oxidation that any ionization is going to be a redox reaction, right? It's a transfer of electrons. Three is just a generic example of the same thing. X and Y don't correspond to any real element. There's no symbol X or Y by itself. But XE minus means whatever X is at the moment has the electron. E minus is an electron. Y doesn't have it yet, but Y receives it. So Y is becoming reduced, X is becoming oxidized. The reason redox is so important to the theme of this chapter, which is the processing of fuel, the oxidation of fuel, is that that is how we get the usable energy out of the fuel that I was talking about a little bit ago. We tap the energy from our fuel molecules by oxidizing our fuels and by dismantling the carbon skeleton of the fuel. All right, so keep that in mind. I'll be saying it. I'll be repeating it often. Let's go to slide 4, though, and notice that redox does not have to involve ionization. Clearly, ionization is redox, but there's more than just ionization that can qualify as redox. Here we have a fuel being reacted with oxygen. And that is a specific category of reactions. When a fuel reacts with oxygen, that is called combustion. This is a combustion reaction. What is CH4? You can cheat and look, but don't. Yeah, methane. It's the simplest hydrocarbon, right? We know it as natural gas. So if you have a natural gas heater in your house, that's what it's burning. When we say we're burning something, that is a combustion reaction. A fuel and oxygen. And if it's an organic fuel, which methane, of course, is, any carbon-containing fuel, it doesn't matter what the fuel is, really. If you combust it by reacting it with oxygen, you're going to get the same end products. Carbon dioxide and water are the material outputs, and then a bunch of energy as well, which is why you're doing this, to get that energy to be released. It's, in other words, combustion is exergonic. That's how we get our energy out of our fuels, by combusting them. Well, this is a one-step process. This is not just a summary reaction. This is actually a one-stepper. That's what we do when we put flame to natural gas. We're causing it in one step to get turned into carbon dioxide and water. Cells don't do that, as we've talked about, because it would be too explosive and rapid a release of energy. Even if it didn't kill the cell because of all that release of heat, it wouldn't give the cell a chance to efficiently harness that energy and put it into the form of ATP storage that we'll be talking more about. But if you do this step by step rather than in one reaction, you still have overall the same delta G. Because the delta G, remember, only cares about starting G and ending G. If you take multiple steps, you still fall the same distance. And so we can do it in a lot of steps, release the same amount of energy, but in manageable parcels that can give the cell a chance to make, hopefully, the maximum amount of ATP. Okay, now back to why this is redox. Here we don't have a transfer of electrons. It's not an ionization. But there is it still qualifies as redox because electrons end up moving closer to an atomic nucleus. Think about this in terms of energy levels, right? The lowest energy level is the closest one to the nucleus. The farther you get the electrons from the nucleus, the higher the energy level is. Okay, the electrons here are the blue dots. This is methane, one methane molecule. But notice that there's four carbon-hydrogen bonds in methane. And methane, like all hydrocarbons, are nonpolar because of what reason? What makes hydrocarbons nonpolar? Right, which results in what? What's the consequence of having pretty much equal electronegativities? Right, there is equal sharing of electrons, which is why they are shown halfway between the two nuclei. They're not particularly close to the hydrogen or the carbon, the electrons that are shared. Okay? This is why hydrocarbons make good fuel, because these electrons that are more or less halfway between the nuclei can be put to a lower energy level by getting close to one of those two atomic nuclei. That's going to release energy, right? Okay, well, let's look at the rearrangement. Oh, before we get to the products, the other reactant, of course, is oxygen. Oxygens are greedy, but when you have two of them, they're equally greedy. So once again, you have equal sharing, and it's not particularly close to either nucleus. But when you let this rearrangement occur by letting the combustion reaction happen, notice the positions of the electrons now. They are now much closer to one atomic nucleus than the other. And it shouldn't surprise you that they get close to the oxygens, because oxygen has a much higher electronegativity than carbon or hydrogen. So the carbon dioxide is formed, the water is formed, but the thing that gets oxidized in a combustion reaction is the fuel, whatever it is. In this case, it's methane, but whatever the fuel is, it's going to be glucose for the rest of the chapter. Whatever the fuel is, though, that is what gets oxidized. And so cement it in your brain that we tap energy from fuels by oxidizing those fuels. The oxygen in the combustion reaction is the thing that gets reduced. It's called an oxidizing agent. That's another way of saying it gets reduced. The fuel is a reducing agent. That's another way of saying it gets oxidized. All right? Oxygen gets reduced into water. Fuel gets oxidized into carbon dioxide. Now, carbon dioxide is worthless to a cell in terms of energy. There's no more usable energy in that molecule. Which is why if we can start with a fuel more complex than methane, like glucose, and dismantle it completely so that all we have left over is carbon dioxide, then we've done as efficient a job as possible in using that fuel. And that's why I call the overall process the complete oxidation of glucose. Because you don't have to go to completion. You could go partway. All right? But there's two ways that we make the oxidation complete, starting with a fuel like glucose. We oxidize it, and by oxidizing it, what I mean is that we pick the hydrogens off of it. Because notice that's what happens to the methane. All of the hydrogens get picked off of it to turn it into CO2. So that's part of the complete oxidation. We oxidize it by dehydrogenating it. It's just another word for picking off the hydrogens. But we also dismantle the carbon skeleton. So there's a bunch of hydrogens available. That's what makes it a good fuel. But there's also six carbons in it forming a skeleton, a carbon skeleton, right? To use as much energy as possible, we not only pick all the hydrogens off, but we also dismantle that six carbon skeleton into six individual one carbon compounds, which are the CO2s. When we've done that, we've gotten all the usable energy we can get out of the fuel, and that's why CO2 is just waste product in terms of the reaction in the one direction, the complete oxidation of glucose. And that's why we get rid of the CO2. I mean, I know you've familiar with the fact that you exhale CO2, but have you thought about where that comes from? The CO2 is what's left over of the food that you ate originally. Because you, first of all, digested those food molecules into small enough molecules to actually enter your body. That happens in the small intestine. And then inside the cells of your body, those fuel molecules, largely glucose, get completely dismantled, oxidized to release the energy, and what's left over is CO2 that you exhale. The oxygen that you breathe is required for this as well. I'll tell you specifically how that works a little bit later. What was that? Well, you're still going to be producing CO2 because you can't live without the energy from fuels. If you don't eat, though, you're just going to use stored fuels. So we do store a certain amount of energy in the form of carbohydrate, namely glycogen that I talked about when I compared plant's version of storage polysaccharide to animal. We make glycogen, it's a big function of your liver and your skeletal muscles. There's only so much we can hold that way, and the glycogen stores are full for about enough energy for a day. One day fast, you use your glycogen, and if you still don't eat, then we start burning fats, which are how we store our extra energy that comes in beyond what we need for our activity, right? It's more efficient to store it as fats because fats have more than twice the energy per gram as the other kinds of nutrients. So it comes in as whatever. We turn it into fat to store it. So if you continue not to eat, you're going to lose fat because the fat is the stored fuel. If you deplete all of your fat and still haven't eaten, then instead of dying right away, your body is going to start breaking down the proteins, largely in your muscles. That's the so-called wasting away. You start using proteins, which are normally structures, as fuels. And if you still don't eat, then you die. All right, let's go to 5. And I've already written this, but now you can see a bigger version of it. This is the summary reaction for the complete oxidation of glucose, which is exactly the reverse of the summary reaction for photosynthesis. All right? But I stressed the word summary because it's not the way it happens in cells. It's not a one reaction. Not a one step. It's many steps, but same starting and ending position, so that's why this one reaction summarizes what actually happens. And it's a lot of steps, but however many steps there are does not at all affect delta G, because delta G is only determined by the final G value, the G of this stuff, the products, minus the G of the initial, which is higher because this is an exergonic process, right? So it's a negative delta G. That's why we're doing it, to get the energy out of the fuel, to store it temporarily in the form of ATP molecules, so that we can then spend those ATP molecules to release the energy and power the various endergonic processes that we have to force ourselves to do. Those aren't never going to happen on their own, right? Endergonic processes. Once again, as I said, regardless of what the fuel is, glucose in this case, in a combustion reaction, it's the fuel that becomes oxidized. That's how we get the energy out. And oxygen becomes reduced into water. All right, now, 6. A few minutes ago, I told you that there's two major ways that we maximize the use of our fuel. One is oxidizing, and one is complete dismantling the carbon skeleton. Well, I also, in that paragraph, when I said it originally, said that specifically how we oxidize our fuel is to pick off the hydrogens. So think about what oxidation means. It's removal of electrons, right? Well, if you remove a hydrogen, you're removing an electron. So think of it that way. But that's specifically how we oxidize our fuels, because our fuels contain carbon-hydrogen bonds. There's 12 hydrogens in just one glucose. So there's a lot of opportunity to pick off hydrogens. And the name for removal of hydrogen is dehydrogenation. Right, the D prefix means removal. Well, here we have dehydrogenase, which is what? That's an enzyme, it ends in ASE. This is an example of an enzyme that's not named for the substrate, but for the process it helps out in. The enzyme responsible for speeding up dehydrogenation of fuels is dehydrogenase. Even if it didn't end in ASE, you could tell that this is an enzyme. For what reason? Right. You never write an enzyme's name on either side of the arrow, because it's not a reactant, it's not a product. It doesn't get changed. You write it above or below the arrow, not on either side of it. Okay. This is not a complete molecule that we're looking at here on the left. Right? It has just bonds hanging off of it. The reason they don't show the whole molecule, which usually would be glucose, is because this is just one functional part of that carbon skeleton. It's just one carbon in the skeleton. If you look at the overall structural formula of glucose, there are 6 carbons in it, right? You built that in lab. This is just one of them, and there's 2 hydrogens associated with that one carbon in the skeleton. So there's 2 hydrogens that can be picked off of just this part of the fuel. And that's what's happening here. Okay? So the dehydrogenase enzyme is helping this happen by reducing the activation energy for this dehydrogenation. But it's 2 hydrogens that get picked off at a time. Now, 2 hydrogen atoms are made of what in terms of subatomic particles? If I tell you you have 2 hydrogen atoms, what subatomic particles do you have? 2 protons and 2 electrons, and that's it. All right. So don't think of them as atoms. Just think of them as 4 subatomic particles. 2 protons, 2 electrons. That's what gets removed in one step in dehydrogenation of the fuel. All right. The reason I'm saying this is to make sense of this other thing, this other reactant that we haven't talked about at all. NAD is, you know, that's not a chemical symbol. There's no A or D on the periodic table. NAD is an acronym. Stands for nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. And it is an example of a coenzyme. Coenzymes are substances that more or less carry things from one place to another in a reaction sequence or a pathway. And that's the job of nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, or NAD. It's the main one. There's a one that we'll talk about later that's very related called FAD, but we'll save that for later. They're both coenzymes, though. And these coenzymes, since they are carrying things from somewhere to somewhere else, I want you to think of them in cartoon form in your mind as things that do this in macroscopic life, which are taxis. Right? Taxis are things that pick things up and drop them off. Humans, in the case of a real taxi. But in the case of these coenzymes, the passengers are not humans, of course. The passengers are the subatomic particles that get stripped off of the fuel, specifically electrons and protons. That's why I wanted you to think of them not as whole hydrogen atoms, but as electrons and protons. Okay? Now, just think about the definitions we've already discussed. If NAD as a taxi picks up electrons, what does that do to the NAD? It reduces it. So these things function as enzymes, as coenzymes, by becoming reduced, and then when they drop those electrons off later, becoming re-oxidized. So just like a real taxi can exist in two forms at any given moment, or either of two forms, right? It's either an empty taxi or a full taxi. So it's the same is true for these coenzymes. Each individual coenzyme molecule at any given moment is either in reduced form or oxidized form. Now, notice on the left side of the reaction we have NAD+. That is the oxidized form, the empty taxi. But notice that it is plus, so it has a positive charge to begin with. Now think about the fact that you're taking off two hydrogen atoms, so you really are working with two protons and two electrons. Okay? If you take just one of those two electrons from those four subatomic particles you have to work with and stick them onto NAD+, that's just going to neutralize it into NAD. Clear? That means you still have another electron plus two protons. Well, if you take the other electron and one of the protons, together they make a hydrogen atom. So if you add those all after you've already added the one, then that turns it from NAD to NADH. But you still have one proton left over, right? And that doesn't just cease to exist, it's there. It's just that it doesn't fit into the taxi. But that's why we write in symbol form the reduced form of the coenzyme as NADH and H+. There's a proton in solution also that came from the fuel. It's just not being carried by the taxi.
One proton is H+?
Yeah, a proton and a hydrogen ion and H+ all refer to the same thing, right? Okay, so NADH is the reduced form. That means it's carrying the electrons from the fuel. And those electrons represent energy from the fuel. So when a coenzyme is in its reduced form, it is a highly valuable energy-carrying molecule. The reduced form of the coenzyme is at much higher energy than the oxidized form. But it's not going to keep that energy because it's going to drop those passengers off to a later part of the process that we'll talk about later. That's what coenzymes do, though. As soon as they drop it off, they can go back and pick up more from another round of dehydrogenation until we've picked all of those hydrogens off and dismantled the skeleton. That's where we're heading.